Well, good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Faculty Club of McGill University here on March 27th, 2014. My name is Ian MacDonald. I'm the editor of Policy Magazine and a columnist, political columnist with the Montreal Gazette and iPolitics. And I'm privileged to be with Dr. Henry Mintzberg, the Faculty of Management here at the McGill University, and John Claghorn, Chair, and a serial author. And that's one of the reasons we're here tonight, is to discuss his new ebook, which you can download for free, by the way, at mintzberg.org. Henry, this might get you kicked out of the Authors Guild for giving away your book, but that's a, that's another conversation. I should say, by way of disclosure, that we are Henry is a graduate of Sir George Williams in 1961, and I'm a graduate of Loyola in 1969. And our two schools hated one another in those days. We had a huge hockey rivalry between Loyola and Sir George. And fortunately, sounder heads prevailed, and since 1974, for the last 40 years, the two schools have been united as Concordia University, and we are fellow alums of the same school. So, pleasure to be with you, Henry. I should say, if I haven't, that these proceedings are being webcast live on Canal Savoie, and also taped for later broadcast. So, if you're having trouble sleeping one night at 3 o'clock in the morning, it'll probably be on. Henry, I wanted to begin with a quote from John F. Kennedy from one of the great speeches of the 20th century in West Berlin in 1963, and I know you know it well. He said, "There are many people who don't understand, or say they don't, what is the great issue between the free world and the communist world. Let them come to Berlin. There are those who say that communism is the wave of the future. Let them come to Berlin. And there are some who say in Europe and elsewhere, we can work with the communists. Let them come to Berlin." And he added, "Freedom has many difficulties, and democracy is not perfect. But we have never had to put up a wall to keep our people in, to prevent them from leaving us." JFK went on, "When all are free, we can look forward to the day when this city will be joined as one, and this country and this great continent of Europe in a peaceful and hopeful globe." That's on, anyone of a certain age knows that speech. Everyone else can see it on YouTube. Fast forward to Ronald Reagan at the Brandenburg Gate in 1986. "Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall." In 1989, Henry, as you write, with the fall of Berlin, we saw the end of the Cold War. And in 1991, the end of the Soviet Union itself. From the fall of the Soviet Union in the Soviet Empire in 1981, to the fall of the Twin Towers in 2001, we saw a period that could be called, perhaps, the Pax Americana. But Henry, you've noted that pundits East and West wrote of 1989 as the triumph of capitalism. A quarter of a century later, you write here in Rebalancing Society that they were wrong, dead wrong. And you even quoted Francis Fukuyama from The End of History, that capitalism was the best system ever. So where did we go wrong and how?
It's interesting because we have a view of democracy as being kind of the ideal system, or as Churchill said, the worst system except for all the alternatives. I think Churchill might have been wrong about democracy too, in a sense, because we have a particular form of democracy which grew particularly out of the American Revolution. The Americans didn't invent democracy, but they gave impetus to a particular form of it, and I think of it as a very individualistic form of democracy. But we have three kind of sets of needs. We have personal needs as individuals, we have communal needs as members of communities, and we have national or international needs as collectivities, as people of the world who are worried about this planet, for example. So we have all these needs. America gave impetus to an individualistic form of democracy, which really catered to individual needs, which was good in and of itself. But overdone, it's not good. What happened to American democracy starting in the around 1870 was the Supreme Court started to give recognition to corporations as persons. And gradually over time, and particularly recently since the fall of the Berlin Wall with Citizens United, which was a famous case that opened the floodgates to corporate donations in politics, the sense of individuals got extended to institutions like business corporations, and gradually things went out of balance. So I would see Kennedy's statement as a valid, honest statement comparing what the U.S. was like at that point with the Soviet Union. And the U.S. was much more balanced at that point. With the fall of communism and this capitalism having triumphed and so on, we've been going out of balance. So the Eastern European countries were out of balance on the left side in terms of government controlling almost everything. We've been going out of balance on the other side with corporations and business controlling almost everything, or at least large business. You know, there are kind of exploring businesses that contribute, like Apple, to new ideas and so on. They're exploiting businesses that take advantage of their size. Those have become much more common, and they've been throwing us out of balance, particularly since 1989.
You write here about a culture of greed being, quote, raised to some sort of high calling. We all know the famous quote from Michael Douglas in Wall Street, greed is good, greed works. Let me bring you forward from 1989, 1991 to the financial crisis of 2008 and the subprime mortgage crisis that triggered it. There were $3 trillion in mortgages in America for unqualified lenders. Mortgages were bundled and rated as AAA, as you know. And there's a famous story in Andrew Ross Sorkin's Too Big to Fail about the migrant worker in Central California who got a $700,000 mortgage on a house with no down payment, and he was making $14,000 a year. You know, there was we saw the big firms like Lehman and Bear Stearns and Merrill Lynch all went under in that crisis. There was a $700 billion bailout in America in 2008, the famous auto bailout of 2009. Have we learned anything from that? Because J.P. Morgan Chase just paid $20 billion in fines, and then they turned around and doubled Jamie Dimon's salary as the CEO.
Yeah. Like, he did a good job of managing that process.
Yeah. I mean, and banks have divisions called wealth management. What does that tell you about corporate culture?
Well, you know, I think we've kind of lost it in a way. And, you know, this brings me back to my main sort of area of interest, which is management itself.
Right.
And what that represents to me and all those things that have happened with General Motors being too big to fail, and now people are talking about those big companies that are really engaging in awful stuff being too big to jail. That's the latest. That's the latest. Well, if you want to commit a crime, wear a white collar, not a blue collar.
None of those guys went to jail, right? Not one.
Hardly anybody. I mean, Madoff did, but
that was different.
Yeah, but if you're running one of these big banks or whatever that got involved with those mortgages, there's only two possible explanations for what went on. One is that the management was completely out of touch with what was going on the ground. They didn't meet that guy who earned $14,000, and they didn't know what was going on the ground. It's hard to believe, but a lot of management is completely disconnected. Or the worst of it. The best of it is connected. The worst of it is disconnected. Or they were just so cynical, and that's true of many of them, they were so cynical that they thought this is pure junk, but if we can slough it off on somebody else quick enough, we'll make some money and they'll get stuck. Which is a kind of Ponzi scheme in a way. It's not technically a Ponzi scheme, but it's the idea of, you know, the next one who comes along inherits the junk. So it's largely an issue of mismanagement, and it's largely an issue of what I call corporate entitlement. This belief that somehow corporations can do more or less what they want, and Reagan cut back on regulations, and we've been cutting back on regulations ever since. Just one last comment. In the 30s, we learned that unregulated businesses are a danger to the economy, the domestic economy. In 2009, we learned that unregulated businesses are a danger to the global economy. Not that we're doing anything about it, but it took us 70 or 80 years to make the great jump from it's a danger to domestic, now it's a danger to global, and nobody's doing anything about it because there's no global governance to speak of.
You could walk down the street here, speaking of management, head to the McGill bookstore, and they're probably shelves full of books about leadership, right? But you have written here that there is no leadership without management. Let me suggest you an example of corporate governance and succession, for example, in government. When I was in government in Mr. Mulrooney's office in 1988, Stanley Hart was the Deputy Minister of Finance, McGill Law graduate, and there were four ADMs, Fred Gorbett, David Dodge, Ian Bennett, and Kevin Lynch, and every one of them went on to become the Deputy of Finance. You don't have that kind of depth in government today.
Yeah.
You just don't.
Yeah.
So what do you mean by new management?
By what's new?
New management.
You mean sort of changed management or different management?
Changing the culture, yeah.
Yeah. The separation came largely out of the Harvard Business School, a couple of professors there, that somehow leading is more glamorous than managing. And therefore the serious people lead and the other people sort of manage in the light of these leaders. I think that's part of the problem. And I think part of the larger problem, part of the arrogance that's bringing us down right now. Nobody wants to be managed by somebody who has no leadership capabilities. Well, who should want to be led by somebody who doesn't have any management capabilities? They wouldn't know what's going on. That's what I was inferring before with the subprime mortgages, that some of them just don't know what's going on. But there's this hype about leadership, 10,000 books on Amazon, a few handful on followership. So we're all supposed to be leaders. Leadership is great when it's connected, when it's involved, when it promotes what I like to call communityship. And a lot of the pamphlet is really about the role of community and the role of community organizations, which is what I call the plural sector. And that's critically important to us, but it's on the defensive all the time.
Is it fair to say that the CEO generally brings the vision and the chief operating officer, the COO, runs the trains most of the time?
No, I doubt it. It depends what they're doing. If they're managing the process by which the trains run, that's one thing. If they're managing the bottom line by kind of, you know, doing all kinds of financial things, that's not very healthy. When you read about Goldman Sachs today and a lot of the shenanigans that are taking place. It was in the newspaper again yesterday. Each story gets worse all the time. The one about aluminum, I don't know if you saw that, where they kind of cornered the market on recycled aluminum and were shuffling it around between warehouses because they had worked out a scheme where they collected more money every time they shuffled it around, and they took $5 billion out of what you and I are paying for cans now, for aluminum cans.
Goldman did that.
Goldman did that. It was a full-page article in the New York Times. I'm not talking about some left-wing rag. I'm talking about the New York Times.
So let me ask you about things like income inequality, the 1%, and the Occupy movement. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's all part of the same phenomenon, I think. And it's quite evident that, you know, America, the individualism that was built into the American Constitution, all men are created equal, all white male, all white male propertied men are created equal. It took a while to bring in the women and get rid of property and extend it to non-white people.
You can see that when you visit Thomas Jefferson's estate in Virginia, too.
Yeah. So this is Jefferson and the Declaration of Independence. They were all created equal. Then the corporations came along, property came back in with a vengeance, and America, property became kind of front and center. Came back, particularly in American elections. We kind of follow suit, in a way. I mean, it's pretty tame. The conservative government is just increasing political donations slightly. There's nothing like what's going on in the States, but.
And you write about capitalism as the end of history and hijacking the democracy of a free people.
This is what's going on in the United States today. You know, with the individualism that became so strong in America, there was nevertheless some kind of balance. The plural sector was always very strong in America. Americans are incredible organizers outside of the private sector and certainly outside the public sector. They organize all kinds of associations. But gradually, that diminished and you got more and more attention to what I was going to say is after the war, you had probably the best period of economic growth and social growth in the United States, because you had enormous economic growth, but you had the bringing in of all kinds of social programs after the war. And that was the high point of American economic and social development. Since 1989, you've had exactly the opposite. You've had a complete trashing of social programs and money ending up in fewer and fewer hands, and we know that doesn't breed economic development. When people are struggling just to pay the mortgage on their $500,000 house with their $14,000 salary or whatever, you don't get healthy democracy. You don't get healthy growth. You don't get healthy social programs.
And you have Washington as a dysfunctional town now where there are so many vested interests. There's another famous quote from President Kennedy from his speech in Madison Square Garden in healthcare in 1962. Where he said, 14,000 people have enough money to hire people to look after their interests in Washington, and the rest of them depend upon the President of the United States. But that's not the case today.
I mean,
you can't get a budget passed in Washington. It's taken about 5 years to get
there. No, it's still true. The rest depend on the President of the United States, who can't do anything.
That's right.
That actually applies beautifully.
Right. You write here about the three pillars of a balanced society, private, public, and plural sectors, and you... I would like you to elaborate on that, but you quote to de Tocqueville, I don't know if this is from Democracy in America or not.
Yeah, it's all from.
If we are to remain civilized, the art of associating together must grow and improve. What's the difference between associations and lobbyists?
And lobbyists?
Yeah. I mean, one represents civil society, I guess, and the other represents vested interests.
Yeah, I define the plural side. You know, when people say civil society or not-for-profits or NGOs or whatever, I think it's the same thing as what I call the plural sector. The reason I prefer that label is because that sector, in order to get ourselves out of this mess, that sector has to take its place alongside the other two sectors. And one way to do that is to label it in a way that it sounds like it belongs. Public-private plurals becomes a natural thing. Public-private civil society is kind of like apples and oranges and giraffes. So we need to kind of get our vocabulary straight, and then when we can do that, we can and then we can start to recognize the critical role of that sector.
And what do you mean by pendulum politics?
France is a perfect example of pendulum politics. They swing from the left to the right, to the left to the right. So you got
different girlfriends along the way too.
Different girlfriends. Different girlfriends, right? So you had Sarkozy and now you have Hollande, and they kind of swing back and forth compared with the U.S., for example, which rather than swinging back and forth, I think is stuck in the middle. At least Obama is stuck in the center. Because of all the lobbyists in Washington and all the private interests that are just much, much, much too powerful. The percentage of Americans who were in favor of gun control was huge. And yet the gun lobbyists, managed to scuttle even that legislation.
You mean after Newtown?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's out of control in the U.S. But it's not only the U.S. A Swedish guy came up to me, and I gave a speech in India, actually, about this, and he was in the audience, and he said, well, it's not Sweden, is it? And I said, just you wait. It's coming. It's everywhere. And the income disparities, as I understand it, are increasing in Sweden.
You write about the public-spiritedness of people like Benjamin Franklin and the Franklin Stove and Jonas Salk, the inventor of the polio vaccine, who never took any royalties on their inventions, thought that they belonged to the public. And the New York Times recently had a big Sunday spread on Steve Ellison, a bunch of Oracle, and a bunch of, you know, tech billionaires donating a lot of money for healthcare research in the United States. Talk about the culture of that.
Yeah, you know, we're also obsessed. Part of this whole syndrome is private property. And, you know, this is my shirt, and if you try and take it off my back, I'm going to give you a hard time because it's my shirt, and I'm not sharing it with anybody. But there are things that are common property, and it's a concept that goes way back. The air is common property. Nobody owns the air. Nobody's selling gas masks and charging us, you know, for every breath. And the water is common property. in this part of the world. The Boston Common, which is a park in Boston, actually was the place where people who didn't have land could graze their cows. That was common property. It's not public property. It's not owned by the government. It's common property. And common property is critical for a lot of the things we have. So when Benjamin Franklin developed the Franklin stove, which is still a hugely popular stove.
My grandmother had one, yeah.
Yeah, well, we have one.
The cottage, yeah.
Not Franklin's, but similar. I mean, it really is similar. He didn't collect it. He said this belongs to everybody. And he chose to do that. He could have patented it, obviously, but he made it common property. Wikipedia is the best example of common property. We all own Wikipedia. The government doesn't own Wikipedia. No company owns Wikipedia. We all own Wikipedia. There's a lot of that going on the internet, and there's a lot of that going on in the plural sector now. But economists don't like it, and have looked for every excuse to put it down. Conventional economists, because they think it's all about private property, and private property is important. Public property is important. Common property is also important.
The air is public property too, isn't it? Climate change and all of that.
Well, that's common property that's being destroyed by private property. And I don't only mean corporations. You do it, and I do it. We do it every time we generate garbage. We do it every time we drive our cars, and so on and so forth. So we're all responsible for that. I hadn't thought about it that way, but the climate is common property, and private property, personal as well as corporate, are destroying it.
Well, what belongs more to the people of the earth than the earth itself?
Sure.
So where's the conversation to be had between business and the public and the third P, the plurals, about sustainable development of resources in a way that allows people to create and enjoy wealth while saving the future of the earth, of the planet?
You know, there are lots of corporations that worry about this and are genuinely concerned about it. And there are lots of companies that are doing all kinds of things, and I applaud all that. I don't think corporate social responsibility is going to make up today for corporate social irresponsibility, because there's so much of that that it won't work. But if you go to a country like Brazil, for example, which I think is the most fascinating country I know of, there are a lot of social initiatives, general activities like ethanol in everybody's gas tank and the public being involved in budgeting in a lot of municipalities, and so on and so forth, that are in effect partnerships. Brazil dealt with the HIV/AIDS crisis better than any country, and it was a partnership with efforts from business, from government, and from the plural sector. And the plural sector, by the way, is all kinds, associations of homophiliacs and associations of homosexuals and gay people, and so on and so forth.
You know, just to give you an example of leadership on an environmental issue of, like, acid rain. When President Reagan first came to Ottawa in March of 1981, there were 50,000 people on Capitol Hill chanting, "Stop acid rain." And at the time, he thought acid rain was caused by trees. And when Mr. Mulroney took office in 1984, he made acid rain one of his priorities with Reagan and stuck with it until 1991, when he finally got the acid rain accord with the first President Bush. But in the meantime, Canada had led by example by reducing its emissions by 50% in the seven provinces east of Saskatchewan, had actually got INCO to close down the plant in Sudbury to modernize it that had been the biggest polluter. And of course, those emissions didn't respect borders. They crossed it both ways. So we couldn't get a deal with the Americans unless they agreed to come to the table.
Yeah.
And we stayed with it until they did. And today, acid rain is not a problem. 20 years later, it's gone.
Well, ozone too.
Yes.
What they call the Montreal Accord,
yeah.
Where they dealt with the problem of ozone. It's unimaginable today. That's the difference between pre-1989 and post-1989. It's unimaginable today. If you look at the succession of global warming conferences, it's a joke. It's an absolute joke. They came out of, Durban or somewhere, saying we put numbers on the table. Isn't that wonderful? They put numbers on the table. They're not doing anything. And somebody was telling me recently about a major energy company that in Rio, the last conference, was pronouncing all the right things about climate change, and underneath was doing everything they could to scuttle any agreement. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of stuff that's going on. Things are so out of control. I mean, I have an appendix in there. It runs about 30, 40 pages that I call a rant.
It is a rant.
And just unbelievable, the stuff that's going on.
Let me ask you about the impact of the new technology platforms that we live in today. When the first cell phone was invented and brought out by Bell Labs and AT&T in 1984, that was as big as a shoebox and weighed 3 pounds and cost $4,000 then. There were no commercial applications for the Internet until the World Wide Web was created in 1990. There were no smartphones until BlackBerry invented this one back in 2005. And now we have
9 years.
Now we have all these social media, Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, you name it. But you say that, and I agree with you, that we've somehow, society has been undermined by new technologies, and you write, don't confuse networks with communities, how we're connected without connecting. And, you know, you have Facebook friends and Twitter followers that you've never met.
Yeah.
How is that socializing?
Yeah, I say if you don't understand the difference between a community and a network, try and get your Facebook friends to help you paint your house. there's a difference. Tom Friedman, I'm not a big fan of his, but he said something interesting to one of his colleagues. He said in one of his columns, he said that an Egyptian friend said that the difference between, he didn't say the difference between network and community, but he said the new social media are great for communication, but not for collaboration. That's probably why things like Occupy Wall Street didn't go anywhere, because they knew how to communicate and get together and create a large movement, but they didn't know how to organize to change things. So in the pamphlet, I make a sharp distinction between mass movements that can positively attack things that are unacceptable. They can challenge things that are unacceptable. But it's social initiatives. They're usually very small groups that generate something new in communities or within small areas. So Mohammed Yunus was concerned in Bangladesh about women in women getting funds for their small, tiny businesses. He didn't, so far as I know, maybe he did, but he didn't challenge the banks. He simply went around the banks and created his own bank to fund these women. This didn't take a lot of people. It took getting on the ground, finding out what's going on, and working on what they need, and then once you have a prototype, then you can expand it in a large way.
You know, when you see people in restaurants having their BlackBerry breaks between courses and meals, it's really annoying. My mother would have said, stop that at the dinner table. And we don't, there aren't sort of, there are conventions that of socialization and behavior that have kind of fallen by the wayside. How many people walk down the street doing this, bumping into people, right?
Yeah, I was just going to say, one of the things that amuses me, because I think it's not so much the social media I'm attacking, it's all the new technologies from a long time ago. The car, the railroad, television, computers themselves, they've all driven us into a much more individualistic way of acting. Because, I lived in France when it was hard to get phones. And people I knew faintly would just come and knock on the door because they couldn't call. And it was very personal, very communal, very kind of interactive. Once you get a phone, you stay away and you keep in touch, but it's not as intimate. Then we get cars and we wrap this hunk of metal around us and it's kind of get off my road. They're tailgating. What are you doing on my road? People don't tailgate on the sidewalk, which is more community. But then I thought, well, they don't tailgate on the sidewalk, but they bump into you when they're texting. So the technology is really a big part of the problem and has undermined the plural sector.
Let me come back to markets for a bit. You write of markets of entitlement. What do you mean by that? And stockholders claim wealth they do little to create.
Say it again, the last part.
That stockholders claim wealth they do little to create, and there's nothing for employees.
Yeah, somebody wrote a book, Marjorie Kelly, about the feudal nature of the financial world today, that just as feudal lords didn't contribute anything to the land they owned, other than inheriting it and making sure to keep other people away from it except to do their bidding. And we have the same thing today with stockholders, who may contribute absolutely nothing. Initially, of course, they provide funds, but after a while, if the company's not going to the market for more funds, the stockholders aren't contributing. Of course, they're owners in a sense, but day traders go in the morning and out in the afternoon, and they're the owners. And employees who work for 30 years in the company are not the owners, and if the stock dips if the stock, not the stock, but if the earnings, you know, come below expectations, the first thing almost every chief executive of major corporation does today is fire 5,000 workers. And it's kind of like, well, how come they weren't redundant last week? How come they're redundant this week because they didn't make your expectations on Wall Street? And what does that do to a company? Because the great companies, whether business or anything else, the great companies are communities. People have a strong feeling about what those companies are, and the, you know, if imagine working for Apple, you have a kind of real sense under Steve Jobs. You have a real sense of they're really doing, my company is doing fantastic things. Great companies, the way I put it in the pamphlet, are communities of human beings. They're not collections of human resources. But when you fire 5,000 people, you know, in one fell swoop, what are you doing to the culture and the sense of community in that company? You're destroying it. Well, absolutely destroying.
Talk about companies and communities. What about the example of Heinz in Leamington, Ontario? They've been in that town for 100 years. That's a community. What do they do?
Yeah. Up and go. Until they're offered more money or something.
Yeah. You quote Pope Francis, quote, money must serve, not rule.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. Thank God he's saying that. Well, it's good. I've got support.
There'll be a papal encyclical. Let me, in your rant, you touch on five issues you see in the United States: incarceration, obesity, healthcare, antidepressants, and voter turnout. You want to walk through some of those numbers? They're pretty scary.
Yeah, give me them one at a time.
Incarceration. California spends more on prisons than it does on high schools.
Yeah. Amazing.
Highest incarceration rate in the world is in America.
Amazing. It's shocking.
Yeah. Obesity, which is Mrs. Obama's pet project.
Yeah, good news, good news. America's now second in the world behind Mexico. But something like
69%?
Yeah, almost 70% of Americans are overweight. Obese, about 40%. It's absolutely shocking. I mean, if you put all those, each of those together in my rant, you start to realize what's going on. What's the other one?
Healthcare and the cost of healthcare in America.
Yeah, the highest in the world.
17% of GDP compared to 9% in Canada.
No, about 11.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And 46% of Americans don't. 46 million Americans don't have healthcare coverage.
Yeah.
This is what Obamacare is all about.
And the overall delivery of healthcare in the United States is not particularly good. America does not rank high. On average, worldwide, so people say, yeah, but the rich do well. Well, good news for you. The wealthy, most educated Americans, according to one study, have worse health care outcomes than the poorest, least educated Brits.
Yikes.
Now, that's not necessarily health care. That could be a lifestyle. In fact, those people, the wealthiest, are probably, you know, many of them are so tense and so driven that they just, you know, get heart attacks in great numbers. But if you're a poor guy living in East London or something, I guess you don't have a heart attack because you don't worry about anything. Because no use anyway.
Antidepressants. It's shocking the number of Americans who are on meds.
Yeah, yeah, and also drug use. Yeah, by drug I mean illicit drug.
That definition is changing as we speak.
Yeah, by the hour.
And finally, voter turnout is the fifth of your
that's
bullets.
The most shocking. No, there's one that's more shocking than that. The U.S. ranks very, very low in voter turnout compared to other countries in the world, very low. The most shocking of all is social mobility, because the American Revolution was about social mobility. People left Europe wherever they came from, whether it was Britain or Russia later or Poland or Vietnam or wherever they came to the land of opportunity.
That's what Lady Liberty is all about, yeah.
Yeah, where they could make it. Canada is far ahead of the United States now on social mobility. The odds of a kid getting ahead, being born poor, is something three times as high. If I remember the figures correctly, it's about 19% in the U.S. and about 45% in Canada, something like that. The figures are shocking, not just compared to Canada, but compared to a number of other countries. So the great American dream, which of course still exists, because people do go from rags to riches, but far fewer, and the odds are stacked much more than they've ever been against poor people.
Let me come back to the conclude this part of the conversation with the East-West, where we started. With Ukraine, Crimea, Putin. $60 billion of investment has left Russia in the first quarter of this year. The stock market has tanked. They've had to protect, the central bank has had to step in to protect the ruble. But you still get the sense that Putin is doing all this because he can.
Yeah, because he can, sure.
Yeah.
Sure. You know what's interesting about that? Not exactly that, although that's part of it, but...
It's not because they lost in hockey.
You never know. Good thing we didn't lose in hockey. God knows what Harper would have done.
It wouldn't have been good for his book sales, that's for sure.
I wrote one paragraph in the morning of February 28th, and the pamphlet went up in the afternoon. It's the last thing I wrote over the screams of a very close friend who was kind of editing it and said, you can't do that. Because I showed him what I was intending to do. What actually stunned me is that there are four countries in the world, now or recently, on four different continents that have all been going through or have gone through recently the same thing. I'm referring to Venezuela, I'm referring to the Ukraine, I'm referring to Thailand, and I'm referring to Egypt under Morsi. In all cases, you had governments elected, populist governments, more or less, elected, and you had the have-nots kind of in power, regardless how corrupt those leaders might have been, and you had the haves in the streets protesting. So you had the educated in Thailand, in Caracas, in all four of those countries, you had the educated on the streets.
Telling the world about it on this.
Yeah, yeah, and then you got violence in all four countries, some more, some less, but there was violence in all these places. So you have a real shift towards the kind of populist, and then I kind of got a label for that, this is post-pamphlet, and I said, well, it's a kind of exclusive populism. It's populism that once elected excludes the people who elected them, who didn't elect them, and only the narrow group that elected them, even though, or at least their own in-group. Other people may have voted for them too, but like Morsi, once they got in, they focused on the Muslim Brotherhood interests and not other people. Harper's done much the same thing in Canada, it seems to me, where he had a kind of, you had liberals voting for him because they were worried about the NDP coming in, but Harper has been catering to a particular constituency, but you had it with the Russian-speaking people in Ukraine, you had it in all four countries. And then I say, well, what's the hope? And then I go back to Brazil, and I say, what's interesting about Brazil is that it seems to have an inclusive kind of populism, or I prefer to call it pluralism, an inclusive kind of pluralism, in the sense that this is a left-wing government, somewhat left-wing government, but has reached out to be much more inclusive than Chavez, for example, did. And now you've got Peru and Bolivia following, and they could be imitating Chavez, but it looks like, it's early, but it looks like they're more inclined to imitate Lula and his successor, what's happening in Brazil. So countering those four countries that are looking very bleak is this movement in South America. And And I think what's so interesting about Brazil is that it's very big, very powerful, very confident, and it just does what it wants to do. And it challenges in some major ways. It's challenged the United States, and particularly vis-a-vis its pharmaceutical companies when they dealt with the HIV/AIDS crisis and so on. They're gutsy, but they're also creative.
I have a sense that I think someone said in one of the blogs yesterday that if Mr. Harper had been asked to do one of his piano solos with his side band, that it would have been back in the USSR at the nuclear summit this week. Okay, well, we have half an hour for Q&A. There are two mics here. I'm going to have House of Commons rules. You can say whatever you want, but ask a question and keep it to 30 seconds.
Does that happen in the House of Commons?
Yes, it does. Mr. Speaker, it's an outrage, blah, blah, blah. So we have two floor mics, and reminder, it's on television. This is not Chatham House rules. Could you just identify yourself?
Patrick Hergen. I thought your point about these four countries was very interesting, and the take of economists on that issue has been more of a question of majoritarianism, in which you sort of the majority rules over the minority and doesn't really take their interests into consideration. So my question is, I mean, in cases like that, it really is the rights that are enshrined in the Constitution, these individual rights that protect the rights of the minority against overreach by the majority. I'm just wondering how you square this with your earlier skepticism with respect to individual rights.
Well, the way I deal with that, I do address that, is I say a healthy democracy combines or attends to individual rights and needs, communal rights and needs, and collective rights and needs. What you've got in the United States is largely a democracy of individualism, of individual needs. What you've got in some of those countries or some of those places you mentioned, like Venezuela or whatever, are attending to collective needs of the group that elected them, and the hell with communal needs. So communal needs, now obviously in any country there's such a range of communal needs. If you're in France, to reconcile what the Front National wants to do with what the socialists want to do is impossible. But there is a sense of protecting communal needs. That's why we're having such a fuss in Quebec right now, because Quebec, on one hand, is very sensitive to community, and there's a very strong feeling of community in Quebec as long as you're present, at least for the, I'm not talking about everybody, but I'm talking about the Parti Québécois. And there's a sense of communal needs that they're absolutely ignoring. So you need to cater to all three. That's what balance is. That's what a healthy democracy is.
So I have a short follow-up question. That's a very interesting response, and you sort of see how in any democracy you've got protections for the majority, so the protections the majority needs, and in most constitutional representative democracies, you've got protection of individual rights. And you bring up a very interesting point concerning communal rights. In your opinion, is there any nation or any example that you give of government that protects these communal rights?
Well, you know, it's long been an issue in Canada, and certainly has historically, recent history, been dealt with that way when we talk about ethnic or whatever, you know, non-French, non-English. That's certainly been, you know, if the government is dealing with Aboriginal needs, I'm not sure I can assess that, whether they really are or not, but that would be an example of catering to communal needs. So this country kind of has a history of that, and countries that welcome, I think I'm back to Brazil, because Brazil really welcomes all kinds of groups, and it's quite amazing. I was at a conference, small conference that a friend of mine runs in Brazil, and there's a movement to take over, to seize farmland that's not being used by unemployed farm people, and they simply take over the land and grow things on it. Now, in the United States, that guy would last 10 minutes before he ended up in jail. This guy was at the conference, and he's a hero for many people in that country, presumably not for the landowners, but he's a hero for many people in that country, and he was handing out jams and jellies that they had made on this, you know, bottles of jams and jellies that they had made on this farms, these farms. So he's not in jail. He's almost highly regarded. I mean, he is highly regarded by many Brazilians. I can't talk for all 180 million, whatever it is, Brazilians, but there is. So there are countries that are concerned with valid, you know, reasonable communal needs.
Thank you very much.
Sounds like the commercialization of the Occupy movement in Brazil.
In a way, yeah, it's true. They didn't have much land to grow. Can't grow anything on Wall Street except money.
So.
Hi, good evening. My name is Kelly Ramey. I've always been under the impression that there was this consensus in the West that the fall of the Berlin Wall was a good event for the globe as a whole.
Sorry, the problems are...
Can you hear me now? Is this better?
Yeah.
Okay. I've always been of the impression that in the West it was a consensus that the fall of the Berlin Wall was a good event for the world as a whole. But some of your comments this evening lead me to believe that that may not be a feeling you share. Would we all, as a planet, have been better off if the Soviet Union had survived? For all the reasons you've mentioned, would that have led us to a better outcome than the one we're in now?
Well, it wouldn't have led to a better outcome for hundreds of millions of people in Eastern Europe, so I'm not sure.
But as a whole, I mean, if you balance one against the other as a globe, as a planet, perhaps the several hundred million people in Eastern Europe may have had worse outcomes, but the globe as a whole, some of the problems you mentioned, the breakdown in democracy, the breakdown in the plural sector, et cetera, if you had to balance one against the other and make the call, if you were the ref back in 89, would you have allowed the Soviet Union to break up if you had the power to prevent it?
Well, you know, if we're allowed to speculate, then let me speculate another scenario, which is that we were smart enough when communism collapsed under its own weight largely. It was certainly pushed by the West, but it collapsed largely under its own weight. If we'd been smart enough to say what caused this, instead of the idiocy of a book called The End of History that argues that we had achieved, literally, that we had achieved perfection. I mean, his argument was that capitalism was not only the best system or the best system ever, but the best system forever. He called it the end of history because history's over. We've now achieved perfection. I don't believe there's any conceivable way to achieve perfection no matter what. But for that argument, even to make the cover of Fortune magazine and to get the attention it did, it was infantile. It was imbecilic. And yet it got all that attention. And if we had been half smart, you know, we could have stepped back from that and said, just wait a minute, that's not what happened. But it's also the mixing up of capitalism with everything. Capitalism has been a very effective way to raise money for corporate enterprise. That's what capitalism is. Capitalism is a way of raising capital to fund corporate enterprise. Suddenly it's become the be-all and end-all of society. We even use terms like democratic capitalism. Notice that capitalism is the noun and democratic is the adjective. We have democratic capitalism. It's crazy. Capitalism is fine for funding enterprises. I don't think it's that fine because we've got all problems with the short-termism of the stock markets. But it's a reasonable system that could be fixed. But there are all kinds of things going on that have nothing to do with capitalism and are only damaged when we talk about capitalism. When Kennedy talked about freedom, we talk about free enterprise as part of freedom. But what we end up with now is free enterprises. We end up with enterprises that are not being regulated or controlled, like the big banks during the mortgage crisis and so on. So we're completely confusing these things. So my scenario is not that the people of Eastern Europe should have lived under capitalism so we could have a better system, but that people were smart enough to realize what was going on. You know, they had a saying in Eastern Europe that capitalism is the exploitation of man by man, communism is the opposite. I mean, they were smart enough to understand that. We weren't.
Do you, a lot of your comments appear, for someone who is not familiar with your work, to be somewhat negative. Do you have any reason for hope? Do you foresee the possibility that as a society, we will collectively become aware of these problems and make an effort to change them? Or have you already thrown in the towel and this is kind of the post-mortem of this 50s, 60s, I can't remember the word you used, but the pinnacle of democratic and social balance?
No, I haven't given up hope at all. I think there, I talked about Brazil now a few minutes ago. The end of the pamphlet talks about you, me, and we, because it's not up to them, it's up to you, it's up to you, it's up to me, and it's up to we acting as subjects, I always mix up subjects and objects, but acting positively rather than reacting negatively. And there's so many social movements going on now that are very positive, very constructive, and particularly younger generations are doing all kinds of wonderful things. But we've got to break the logjam. I'll give you just one example of how bad things are and how many people are even aware of this. NAFTA includes a tribunal that is untransparent, closed door, has no recourse once they decide. And what they can do is Canada can be sued by American companies under, or Mexican companies under NAFTA if something they did was found to interfere with their profit. And they're literally going after every piece of environmental and social legislation under that clause. If you introduce a piece of environmental legislation, some company that might be hurt by attempts to save the environment sues the Canadian government. Now, they claim that the courts have no recourse, but I can't imagine, spoke to a Supreme Court justice, I know, our next one, about this, but I can't imagine that courts can't strike those clauses down. Now, let me tell you what's happened. In Africa and parts of Asia, very poor countries have tried to do with tobacco, cigarettes, what we did long ago, which was, you know, put warnings on packages. Particularly, I forget the country, but one country wanted to include warnings to get women off cigarettes. They were sued by Philip Morris, and they were sued some of them were sued by Philip Morris, and some of them were sued by Association of Tobacco Companies as this interfering with their profits. And so they couldn't fight back because they couldn't afford, these were poor countries, couldn't afford the legal costs of fighting back. In other words, corporate interests now have the power to stop governments all over the world that sign these bilateral treaties, to stop those governments from legislating on social issues, environmental issues. It's mind-blowing. And I'm not making this up. In the pamphlet, there's references to this has all been documented. So people don't realize what's going on.
Here we go.
Yes, Dr. Mintzberg, Marie-Sénécal Tremblay, I'm an ex-student of yours. And my question reverts back...
I hope you ask a good question.
We'll see. My question reverts back to your comments on Brazil. You mentioned it as an example of some of the inclusive pluralism, and also referred, among other things, to the way they handled their HIV crisis and distribution of how they approach that crisis. One of the key players in that distribution network solution, which was a very multi-sectorial one, was the Catholic Church, actually, in Brazil. And I wondered if you had some thoughts that you would share with us about the role of, obviously, one of the classic plural members of civil society, the church, i.e. religious institutions generally, but in this sort of new tripartite model that you're putting forward, that you're saying is the solution.
Yeah.
And in particular with Brazil, what's so interesting, obviously, is the liberation theology movement, which started there post-Vatican II. But your thoughts on that and the role of religious institutions generally going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. Brazil apparently didn't start liberation theology, but it probably has carried it farther than any other country. Mm. Not coincidentally, it's Brazil, and not coincidentally, the previous pope, at least, was not very happy with all this.
Neither was the one before that.
Yeah, that's right. But they have done some absolutely wonderful things. I imagine this pope, even if he might not admit it, I don't know if he's pronounced on it, would probably be much more tolerant, especially being South American himself. Mm-hmm. But then you get the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. You know, I always wondered if we could do an accounting of how many people were killed by religion and how many people were saved by religion. I always thought it would be about 50-50. So there are religions that are doing wonderful things, and there are religions that are doing awful things. Taliban. So.
Hi, Jeff Shore. Thank you both for being here. This is a little simpler of a question, but you spoke a lot about one side of the unbalanced equation. How can we individually do things to rebalance the other way? You can just give us suggestions.
Yeah, I won't talk about the next election.
That's fine.
I'm shocked by what's going on in my own country. I'm absolutely shocked. There's a kind of sense of meanness that has come into this country which I never remember seeing. There's a sense of narrowness. There's a nastiness in Ottawa that is absolutely shocking. And yet, I think in our genes, as Canadians, we were always balanced, sensible. You know, we were much more concerned about peacekeeping than we were about fighting wars. You know why we went to Afghanistan, I think? Because we were in purgatory. We told the Americans no for Iraq, and we couldn't say no again. In my opinion, that's why we were in Afghanistan. An absolutely awful situation for the Americans as well. And Obama, I think, too, had to show that he was the tough guy, so he was moving out of Iraq, and he couldn't move that quickly out of Afghanistan. Afghanistan has scuttled every conqueror for such a long time. So we were a different kind of country, and I believe that cultures don't disappear that quickly. They can be damaged, they can be shifted, but the heart and soul of that culture remains. I think a lot of it remains in the CBC, which is just so good, that it still continues to represent the best of this country. And I don't mean politically, I mean just, they have, you know, it's amazing. They have this habit of finding out of 30-odd million Canadians these amazing people. I'm talking about radio. These amazing people, just one after the other. And then I read the New York Times, and frankly, there's one or two columnists who are excellent. I think 300 million people, they can't find, you know, interesting people. They've got. I think Brooks is amazing.
He's from Toronto.
Is he? Wow, I didn't know that. Oh, wow, that's helpful.
You won't get into that political.
And by the way, the other one is Freeland, who writes not regularly but fairly often, and she's a member of Parliament.
Christy, yeah.
Yeah. So that's interesting. He's Canadian. Oh, yeah. My goodness. Wow. I didn't know that.
One takeaway day-to-day for just us in this room, just general people.
One takeaway?
Yeah.
Well, one of the things I say in the pamphlet is that if you want to see an exploiter, look in your own mirror. And because we all exploit. And there's an awful lot that people can do if they stop doing things that are damaging and they start to get active about changing things. We've become so passive because, you know, we sit in front of the television or whatever we do, and we're not in any way we can. I mean, you know, I remember reading years ago about a doctor, a Belgian doctor who went to some part of Africa and dug a well for a local village. That's all they did. And they got a source of water. There's all kinds of things that everybody can do.
Be good to your neighbor.
Once you start realizing it, you can do it.
Thank you.
Okay, there's a gentleman in the middle here who has a question. Yes, sir. Go to that microphone, please.
Can you use me?
Yes, please. Yeah.
Sure.
As you mentioned, and a lot of us know, there are four countries in the world that they were democratically elected the heads of states, over 51%, and yet there was revolution against them.
Yeah.
On the other hand, in our country, Canada, and as well as United States, I don't believe that most of our, if not all of our governments were elected by less than 50%.
Yeah.
So, does this mean there are certain countries in the world they are just not prepared or not fit to become a democratic country? I would like you to comment on that.
Thank you, sir.
Sure. You know, I think one thing I would be in favor of in countries like Canada, parliamentary democracies, and presidential elections to some extent, is a simple change that if you vote 1-2, instead of just voting one and then you have a run, in Canada you don't have a runoff.
Preferential ballot is what you're talking about.
You don't have a runoff, but in France, other countries, you have a runoff. In Egypt, the choice was between a crony of the old regime and the Muslim Brotherhood. If people could vote 1-2, there'd be a greater chance of getting people who don't represent those extremes.
And the chances of a constitutional amendment on that in Canada and the United States are zero.
Well, it depends who gets elected. I don't think the Conservatives would do that because it doesn't cater to them.
It's at least a 750.
Yeah. But I would think it would cater to the Liberals. If the Liberals came in with the majority, I would think it would benefit.
Yeah, but you need, for something like that, you need a constitutional amendment.
Oh, I see what you mean, and you need all the...
We need at least 750 if not unanimity.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Yes, sir.
Hi, I'm Xavier Milton. Thanks very much for your insightful paper. One comment I remember from reading de Tocqueville was the American industrial model made it such that the workers were so distracted with the work that it prevented them from interacting with civil society, with governments, participating in democracy, per se. And that I thought was an interesting comment from his tour in America. And if you hold that thought, I recall reading in your pamphlet, you were touched on those sort of workers' council notion in Germany. And I'd wondered if you could sort of expand on that. I think it was in one of your footnotes. But I think I'm wondering whether you could expand on that and whether that would help rebalance the system or society. If you could sort of expand on the workers' role on the councils and the boards to prevent precisely sort of what you were mentioning earlier, day traders and the impacts where it's essentially the owners and the CEOs who are managing. So if you could maybe comment on that, I'd appreciate it.
Well, I can't imagine America accepting that half the seats on corporate boards would come from worker representatives. That just never happened. And I'm not necessarily promoting it. But Germany has had it for many years, and the German economy is fabulous. Economically, it's fabulous. So it obviously hasn't, you know, you could say France, Italy have economic trouble, Spain. Germany has had this for decades, and it's done extremely well, so, and still does extremely well, and has probably the highest, I haven't seen figures, but I would guess the highest or close to the highest wage rates in the world, and yet they just produce high quality, excellent products that sell. So it hasn't hurt Germany. If we open our minds to new ways of doing things instead of this economic dogma that is absolutely swamping us, you know, that greed is good and markets are sufficient to do anything and property is sacrosanct and governments are suspect. It's just nonsense. You know, as one view of human, it's quoted from my own pamphlet, but as one view of human nature, it makes some sense. As the view of human nature, it's complete and utter nonsense. And yet, it dominates. Of course, it dominates because it plays into the hands of the enterprises that have the most power. It's great for them. So, you know, if we open up our minds, you know, The Brazilians are a why not people, I think. I did a paper with Gui Azevedo, one of my doctoral students, on Brazil. He's from Brazil. And we call the Brazilians a kind of why not people. And it's why not people who change the world. It's not people who say, why, you can't do that, there's a million reasons why it won't work. It's the why not people who say, ah, what the hell, give it a try, we'll see what works. If it doesn't work, we'll try something else.
One last one at the back. Did you have a question? Oh, sorry. Last one.
I'm not sure I should be saying my name here. I'm Susan Mintzberg. And I was going to save this for a private conversation, but I couldn't resist. You were saying that we all exploit. That was something you said earlier. And then you also say in the panel that it's up to you, me, and we. But then there's also this idea that we expect other people to do it. You know, we're not going to make the change. We expect everyone else to do it. And then when I got to the end of your pamphlet, the first thing that sort of hit me, and the main comment I wanted to bring to you privately, but here we go. Isn't human nature largely selfish? That's sort of been my experience in life. Human beings tend, you know, we look at, it's me. It's and if that's the case, how do we change human nature? Or can we?
Well, that's the economic view, that we're all out for ourselves. And in fact, the distortion of what Adam Smith wrote a long time ago about if the butcher and the baker and the brewer in 1776, if they looked after themselves, they would be looking after everybody because they would be bringing the best products and so on in an open market. So, of course, Smith wrote a whole other book about exactly the opposite, about the need for much broader serving. We're all, you know, what I always want to say to an economist who says, and it applies to you beautifully, Susie, but what I always want to say to an economist is, who professes that it's all about greed and all about self-service, and what I want to say is, did you have a mother? because if there's any, I'll bet a lot of these economists must have had horrible mothers because if there's any human being on earth who is not self-serving and totally for somebody else, it's mothers. So we're as hardwired to be generous and embracing and social and involving as we are to be self-centered and individualistic. But the trouble is, we played so much on one side, and if you build a society like that, it's trouble. And I think one of the big problems of the American society is it's been so... The American Constitution was very careful about checks and balances. But they were checks and balances on government, because obviously they were coming off the power of the British king, who was driving them crazy, so they instituted checks and balances to limit their government. They succeeded with a vengeance, so the rest of society kind of had free rein. Now, there were two parts to the rest of society. There was private and there was plural. And America was very strong on the plural as well as the private sector. Americans organized more than anybody on earth. I once came across the Flying Funeral Directors of America, you know. So they organized at the drop of a hat about everything. But because of what I was talking about earlier about the effects of technology, and the effects of the growth and the power of the private sector, the plural sector has been diminished enormously. And so the imbalance in the United States comes from those forces. I maintain at the end of the pamphlet that what America needs is checks and balances on the private sector. And the whole world needs checks and balances on the private sector. And we can start on the global level because there are very few constraints on global corporations. Very few constraints on global corporations.
Okay, we have to end it there. I'm sorry. A couple of housekeeping announcements. For those of you who have signed up for the re-envisioning sessions, just head up to the dining room upstairs. For the rest of you, we wanted to get you out of here in time to get home for either the Habs at Detroit. Go Habs, go. Thank you. Toronto's going to miss the playoffs. That's great.
The debate.
Or the debate at 8 o'clock. The Liberals are winning. Thank you all. Thank you.
Sorry, Henry just wanted to say.
disciplines.
Yeah. For those who are joining the second part, we're convening upstairs at 7:15. These are the people who signed up for part two and have read the pamphlet. If you haven't read the pamphlet, you'll be holding up people at your table. So leave those spaces for people who have read. Great.